watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Memorial Day began its celebration here in the Finger Lakes in Waterloo, New York. In order to commemorate American war dead, there have been a lot of American wars and a lot of dead people. And the fact is, there is a long history of the government lying to the people about the real motivation for war, which boils down to mostly defending the freedom of rich men to buy low and sell high. Expanding the assets of the rulers has always been the reason behind military aggression. This week, two workshops on getting people out of the military and keeping them out, so that one day they will give a war, but no one will come. George King introduces our first presentation.
This is a recording of Amy Allison and Aidan Delgado on Throwing Down Against Empire, Military Veterans Speak Out on Practical Strategies to End War. They spoke at the National Conference on Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on February 5, 2006. Is it possible to build an anti-war movement that not only ends the occupation of Iraq, but challenges the foundations of war? The U.S. anti-war movement is successfully using counter-recruitment as a strategy to weaken the military and galvanize anti-war opposition in working-class communities and on campuses around the country. Resistance in the military by GIs is also on the rise, with soldiers refusing orders and coming out as conscientious objectors. Also, veterans are at the center of today's anti-war movement, and this panel brings together veterans of the Persian Gulf and Iraq wars to share their experiences of resistance and organizing. They also discuss conscientious objection and counter-recruitment as core strategies for building an anti-war movement that can end this war and challenge imperialism. Amy Allison earned an honorable discharge as a conscientious objector during the Persian Gulf War after serving 4 years as a combat medic in the Army Reserves. Today, she supports soldiers applying for CO discharges and writes and speaks about the experience and role of GI resistance in ending the war. She is a leader in the counter-recruitment movement, serving on the steering committee of San Francisco's College Not Combat Initiative and the National Network Opposing the Militarization of Youth, to restrict recruiters from public school campuses through education, direct action, and legislation. In addition, she makes frequent presentations to youth and their families about alternatives to military service for education and job opportunities, most recently to immigrant communities. She is running for a seat on the City Council of Oakland, California, to bring progressive peace and justice values to local governance priorities. Aidan Delgado is a U.S. Army Reserve soldier recently returned from combat duty in Iraq, including 6 months at the Abu Ghraib prison. He received an honorable discharge and was awarded 4 service medals. He was ultimately granted conscientious objector status and is now attending a Florida Honors College, completing a degree in religion. He has worked with Iraq Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Common Sense. This panel was co-sponsored by the Catalyst Project and the War Resisters League and moderated by Claire Bayard. Claire Bayard is a core organizer and trainer with the Catalyst Project and works with the Heads Up Collective, an anti-racist organization challenging U.S. wars at home and abroad. Claire works to strengthen alliances between majority-white global justice anti-war groups and immigrant-led economic and racial justice organizations, including the Deporten a la Migra Coalition in San Francisco. As a member of Catalyst, Claire serves on the National Committee of the War Resisters League, supporting counter-military recruitment organizing and GI resistance.
Okay, hi. Welcome, folks. Thanks for coming out early on a Sunday morning. My name is Claire. I'm going to be moderating along with Steve from the War Resisters League. This panel is being co-sponsored by War Resisters League and the Catalyst Project.
So the War Resisters League has been around for about 84 years. We're one of the oldest peace and justice organizations in the country. And our work is now focused on doing counter-military recruitment with young people around the country and also challenging war profiteers and corporate profits that are made off of war. Our national office is based in New York, which is where I work. And you can get more information about our program on our website, which is warresisters.org.
So the strategy of challenging the military is seen the military as being a weak link in that it both is really relying on a constant source of working class folks, folks of color, to be continuing its project, but that actually those are the same communities that are really being hit by the domestic impacts of war. And so those are actually already the communities that are fighting back. And so looking at challenging the military as a way to really attack that weak link in cutting in impacting its ability to be continuing wars of conquest and also to be resisting the ways that cutbacks and crackdowns are really affecting folks here in the U.S. And so counter-recruitment as a strategy to be trying to cut off that supply, but then there's also the question of what to do with the tremendous numbers of folks in the military who are unhappy with being there, who are actively resisting, and many of whom are also wanting to get out. So the question really that we want to be opening up today and to be hearing the wisdom and experience of Aiden and Amy on is how can we be building an anti-war movement where non-military anti-war activists can actually be building the kind of visible support that can help the growth of a resistance movement from inside the military?
So I just want to give a little bit of context about what's going on in the anti-war movement in the U.S. today before we move on to our panelists. And I'm sure that many of us in this room have taken part in large and small actions against the wars that are going on around the world today that the U.S. is involved in. I want to highlight two things quickly. First is the counter-recruitment movement that Claire mentioned, and the second would be the huge expansion in organizing amongst veterans, military families, and currently enlisted soldiers. Counter-recruitment is kind of like the big buzzword, I think, in the anti-war movement today. But it really is an exciting and emerging and growing community of young people, parents, teachers, youth allies, who are deeply involved in their communities, in their schools, with the PTAs, with the school board, with the teachers, on kicking military recruiters and keeping military recruiters out of the schools. It's a really interesting transition that's happened over the past couple of years. I think right after the beginning of the Iraq War, we saw a huge push for large national mobilizations. And like Claire mentioned, there's been this real shift back towards the local, back towards the very concrete. And we're seeing a real impact. And it's one of the few sectors in the anti-war movement where you could really see some cohesion and something you could call a movement and a community. And it's ever-changing. It's a complicated thing, but it's a really exciting area to point to. And for me, the really exciting thing is it's about stopping the flow of people to the military, right? It's about really cutting off the source for the war. And it's about young folks doing that themselves and really trying to figure out how that makes sense. The other area that's been rapidly expanding has been, as I mentioned, military families, veterans, currently enlisted folks, people going through the conscientious objector process. And this, unfortunately, has been one of the more hidden areas of the anti-war movement. I think anyone who's been to a demonstration or an event recently, there's probably been a speaker from a group like Iraq Vets Against the War or Bring Them Home Now. But we don't often see the voices of vets or military families really centralized and put in the middle of developing our strategy and developing the work that we do. So there's been a number of different things. I want to point out one thing that happened last year that was really exciting. Down in Fayetteville, North Carolina, there was a very large demonstration for Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is one of the most military, one of the most military supported and supporting cities in the country. And there was a demonstration and a conference organized by a number of different organizations, including Iraq Vets Against the War, and Bring Them Home Now, and a bunch of other folks. And it was a really powerful moment to see what this movement can look like when it's really directed by people who have had this as a personal experience. So I came out of that, going to that demonstration and conference, really inspired and really energized. So I think that these two areas of growth are really exciting, they're really motivating, they're inspiring, but they're also challenging, right? We have to look at the limitations of the traditional peace movement and anti-war movement and look in the ways that there's some real growing pains and some real difficulty that's being encountered now, and the ways in which our traditional modes of organizing are holding down these voices, keeping these voices silent, and ways we can shift the way that space is used and the movement is organized so that we can really bring this stuff to the front. So I just wanted to put that out there as some context, young folks organizing, vets, currently enlisted folks and military families organizing. And here to tell us more about that are our stellar panelists, Amy and Aiden.
Good morning. My name's Amy Allison. I'm a combat medic from the Army Reserves. I was in during the Persian Gulf era, so I know most of you were in elementary school. That officially makes me an OG. I get that. As a veteran, as a veteran now, I work with the current generation of soldiers who are questioning what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan and are trying to find out what their alternatives are. And I can do that because I joined the military right out of my high school, right on my high school campus when I was 17, because I wanted to go to college. And the economic incentives that recruiters tell us, combined with the fact that, you know, no adult in my life ever suggested or asked me how I felt about war or how I felt about, you know, putting on a uniform or following orders, none of that. I went right into the military as a naive 17-year-old, only to find out in training that what the military was teaching me violated some of my basic teachings from my family and my basic beliefs. And it took me 6 years and a lot of legal help and support from other veterans to find out how to get out. And in my case, the way that I was ultimately discharged was that I proved that I was a conscientious objector. So for those of you who aren't familiar with that, every member of the military now has a legal right, regardless of what service, if they're Marines or Air Force or Army, a legal right to submit an application proving that they're opposed to war in any form. It's a very, very, very difficult kind of discharge because basically we sign, I sign a contract, or every member of the military signs a contract saying they're not a conscientious objector when they join, so you have to prove that you went through a process. But the military, in some cases, will recognize this. And in my case, I got an honorable discharge as a CO. A few years ago, the American Friends Service Committee hosted a 10-year reunion of war resistors, veterans or soldiers who had become conscientious objectors and then become public against the war during that time in the early 90s. The lessons that came out of that conversation were that the anti-war movement, the one that's organized by ANSWER in terms of big marches, or the ones that, you know, here are, they're very discreet forums, the ones like that that identify veterans or soldiers speaking out, that actually did not do a lot to not only put veterans' voices at the center, but to magnify the importance of soldier resistance in the entire movement. And most importantly, what we learned from our own experience is that the traditional way of organizing that was mentioned earlier actually didn't help those soldiers who had gone through so much, not only to become soldiers, at a very young age you go through intense training, and that training gets into your DNA. And when you say to yourself as a person, I can't do this anymore, the very culture I'm in, because military is not a job, it's a culture, this life that I find myself in is absolutely wrong for me, and I don't believe in the basic assumption that I should be training to kill other people. When you start to reject that, it takes a lot of support over a long time to help a person come to wholeness. So our experience was that those of us who went public, who were willing to come and stand up, and we stood in speeches and whatever, but we did not have a community willing to work with us and help us long term, ended up, a friend of mine went to jail on other charges. Another friend became mentally ill and was homeless and lived under a bridge. Another friend withdrew into her shell almost so she can't deal with the public. The peace movement doesn't understand that war resistors also go through a post-traumatic stress disorder of its own kind. And that what's really needed is for people who support veterans to be thinking about ways to connect and support long-term. And when I heard people talking about their own experiences in this retreat a few years back, I realized that I would never, ever accept any new generation of soldiers who had to confront issues of war and who decided to take a stand against what was happening and leave them hanging. I wouldn't do that. one of the things that we heard in this discussion was the people who were most likely to have long-term relationships were other veterans and religious people. In other words, there wasn't a feeling among veterans that people who were in the anti-war movement gave a crap about their families or helping them transition to civilian life. You know what I mean? That long-term commitment. And so in the last few years, I, through friends of friends, have found soldiers who had questions. Maybe they were active in their reserve unit and their unit was activated, or, you know, and said, first of all, you are going to be okay. No matter what happens to you, you are going to be okay, because I am living proof that you can stand up against the most powerful institution in the world, and as a person, you can survive. And starting from that premise, I care about you, we start talking about their family, we start talking about, you know, if they have kids or their friends or their environment, and bringing legal support and getting advice all around them long term. The first person that I helped in this was Stephen Funk. Stephen Funk was I was his military counselor. Stephen Funk was, I was friends with a friend of his sister's, and that's how I found him. And at that time, his unit had been activated. He and I became good friends, and not only did I help him with the legal aspect of him applying for a discharge as a conscientious objector, getting him help, but I also helped him go public. And going public is a very hard decision for soldiers. There are fewer soldiers public now during the Iraq War than there was during the Persian Gulf War. And I ask myself why that is. The level of fear among general Americans is very intense, but the level of fear about speaking out among soldiers is even more so, if you can imagine. And so it's really important, I feel, and one of the lessons learned is that every individual soldier has to make their own decision based on a lot of factors, you know, how strong they are, how called they are to speak truth to power, the risks associated with it for their own case, and they have to figure out on their own. And so as a movement, we have to value soldiers whether or not they're willing to go public. Whether or not they're willing to speak publicly, their resistance matters. And the final thing I'll say, just in terms of introduction, is I talked to an organizer who does a workshop, and he said in his workshop, in order to get people, participants, to understand what are the pillars that hold up institutions, he has a mattress, and he says, okay, here's our mattress. Now, what are the things that hold? This is the war, okay? This is the war. The whole concept or process. Institution, this war machine, and what holds it up. And one of the pillars, of course, is the corporate media. One of the pillars is, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that hold this up. But the main center pillar are the soldiers. Without soldiers to follow orders, the war machine will fall. And it was demonstrated 30 years ago in Vietnam. And so we realize how critical the work is now. So our effort today is to say that we have to not only acknowledge that, but bring people who may not have a friend or may not have a family member in the service to understand we are all the same, and that there are some very concrete things that we can do to help support people who are resisting at different levels to make the war machine fall. So our own experience really does help to... you know, that we're sharing today really does help to underscore that point. We're going to be talking today about some very concrete actions.
Hi, everybody. My name is Aiden Delgado. I'm a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I think what I'm going to do by way of introduction is tell you a little bit of my story of how I became a conscientious objector and my move from being an enlistee to a political activist in the current context, so you can kind of see what's going on now as a way to both be critical of where the peace movement could be more helpful and to be supportive of areas where it was really helpful. And I think maybe my story will help illustrate that, not because I'm important or you want to hear what happened in my life. I came to America in the year 2000. I lived my whole life overseas. This is my fourth year in America. I enlisted in the Army Reserve on September 11, 2001. I was tired of college. I was bored with school and kind of this intellectual academic world. It was very liberal, very, you know, supportive, but still not, you know, it wasn't the whole picture. So I thought, oh, I'll enlist in the military and get a different skill set. That was the morning of September 11th. After that, everything changed. I served 1 year, about 1.5 years, uneventfully in the reserves. I was activated in January of 2003, spent 2 months in Fort Stewart, and then I was shipped overseas to Camp Arif John, Kuwait, in late March and the first day of April 2003. I crossed the Iraq border in about the second or third week of the war, and I moved into the southern city. I followed the 3rd Infantry Division and moved into the southern city of Nasiriyah, where I stayed at a prison camp called Camp Talil. I spent 6 months there in the south before I was redeployed north to Abu Ghraib prison. While I was there in the south, I began to undergo a transformation. I had always been a liberal Democrat, you know, our house, but it was very intellectual for me. It was very academic. This was the college world. This was the school world. I had opposed the war on grounds of politics. You know, I didn't think it was a good idea. I didn't think it was strategic for the country. But my objection to it wasn't personal until I actually went there and saw the conditions and served there. And what I underwent while I was there in Nasiriyah was a personal change when I saw the prisoners that we were holding in Talil. And I felt a kind of kinship with them because I saw these guys and I thought, well, these are young, poor, uneducated Iraqi guys who didn't have a lot of choices in their life and their government forced them to fight us. And I looked at the guys in my union and I thought, we're exactly the same. We're pretty much in the same scenario. And when I came to that conclusion, I found it impossible to hate them or have any violence for them. And I began to feel my own heart, my own feelings start to change. I had been nominally a Buddhist for a long time, since before I went to basic training, but after I enlisted. But it always was something that was in the back of my mind, you know, like most religion usually is for people. But while I was there in Nasiriyah and Talil, I kind of came to a point where I said, this is going to affect the rest of my life. What kind of man am I going to be? What kind of Buddhist am I going to be? Am I going to be somebody who thinks about it? Or what kind of activist am I going to be? Am I going to be someone who thinks about what's right? Or am I going to be someone who lives it, who acts it? And I agonized over this for months. About the 4th month I was there in Iraq, I went to my commander. I had my assault rifle, my SAW. And I handed it to him and I said, look, I'll stay. I'll do whatever you order me to until I'm released. But you can just take this weapon back because I'm not going to fight and I'm not going to kill anybody. War is wrong and killing is wrong. And I want to be processed as a conscientious objector. I had come to the decision to become a conscientious objector really on my own. Now that I'm a political activist and I go and I speak, now I know there are all these organizations, Center for Conscious Objection, GI Rights. But when I was there, I didn't. All I had was another CO packet that I had downloaded off the internet and read through a bunch of times to give me some idea of what you had to do and what you had to go through in order to become a CO. I didn't really have a counselor. And over there in Iraq, I wasn't able to contact the states for any reason. So that was one area where I was sort of left on my own. And I was able to persevere and do it, but maybe others wouldn't have in the same scenario. My command turned immediately hostile when I applied for CO status. First thing they did was take away my plates in my flak vest. They said, oh, you're not going to fight. You won't need this body armor. Then they said, oh, you can't go home on home leave because you're a sympathizer. You won't come back. And so they had completely shut me off from home. Like, there was no way to go home. Served another 9 months in Iraq after that. When I was redeployed to Abu Ghraib prison, which was infamous at that time for different reasons than it is now, I went through many other difficult experiences, and I saw a lot of things there that further vindicated my decision to become a conscious objector, and I began to further mentally check myself out of what the Army was doing and what my unit was doing. But again, I was completely isolated and shut off, and there was no real contact with home or way to go home. When I finally finished my 1 year in Iraq and returned home, my conscientious objector status was approved, but only because my father and myself had been calling our congressmen and our senators constantly, begging them to, you know, to further the process, to check up on it, and also through the action of General Karpinski from Abu Ghraib prison was instrumental in making that happen. And I went through a long, several months period where I didn't want to talk about the war at all. I just wanted to forget about it. I wanted to put Abu Ghraib out of my mind forever and never return there. But I got so tired of people coming up to me individually and being like, oh, what was the war like? What happened to you? And I'm like, look, I'll get a hall at my school. I'll show slides and I'll give one talk. And then I never want to speak about this ever again. I just want to answer everybody's questions and that'll be the end of it. So I did this and like 500 people showed up. And I gave this presentation and I showed my photos from Abu Ghraib. And people were shocked and they were like, oh my God. And I realized, wow, people really have no concept of all of what's going on in Iraq or what we're doing. So then I ended up having to go here and there and do speeches and talks. And you know, that's what ultimately what brought me here. But it wasn't something that I would have done on my own. People pressured me into doing it. And now I do it, and I'm glad that I do it. But it was something that was difficult initially, and it's still very difficult. Because I don't really like to reopen old wounds. You know, I don't want to dredge it up every day. But I do it because I feel like people have no concept of what's going on in Iraq. And I think that's one real area where the peace movement and Soldiers Together could really improve. And I don't want to get into the strategy until a little bit later once we finish our introductions. But for me, as a soldier, the problems, the criticisms I would have of the peace movement or the ways we could improve, not criticism, the way we could improve was that as a soldier, I felt completely isolated, both when I was in training at Fort Knox and when I was deployed overseas to Iraq. I had no link to a support network. Mostly that's my fault because I was ignorant of what was out there. But also I didn't have access to people who could help me along. And when I came back, I didn't really feel there was a movement that I could step into, or there was no arena that I could step into to cite my opposition to the war. And it was only through chance or happenstance that I ended up getting connected. So I think those are the issues that I want to talk about, and the transition from being a young soldier to being a disaffected soldier to being a political activist. So I guess we get this back.
Okay, so the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to ask Aiden and Amy each a question around strategy, and then you're going to get to ask them some questions, which are those cards. But we're going to start with Aiden telling us a little bit more about what are some concrete ways that any war activists who are outside the military can be supporting these struggles, and also what, if you want to get into a little bit of what the movement has to gain from these voices and from doing that support. That's great, too.
By way of talking about strategy and anti-war activism, I first want to lay out my personal framework for how veterans or soldiers become involved in the peace movement or in political movements. And it's just my thing, or, you know, we kind of came up with it. It's not like a fact, or it's not in a book. But this is the way I framed it in my mind, and I think it may be helpful to analyze where the peace movement is putting disproportionate focus and where there's not enough focus. So I want to talk about kind of five stages of being a soldier. The first stage is being a young person, fresh out of high school or in college or elsewhere, and you enlist. And this is the area where counter-recruitment is active to prevent people from initially enlisting. We have approximately 1 million soldiers armed forces of all branches active in reserve, approximately 1 million. Then there's a period after a young soldier has enlisted, when they go to basic training and they experience a period of sharp initial disaffection. And I would safely say about 95% of soldiers would be willing to quit within the first week of basic training. Most don't, but there's a period of disillusionment. And this can actually happen several times. The first time is in training. Probably it happens again when they get deployed overseas or when they go through some traumatic experience. But there's an initial period where the soldier realizes, wait a second, this is not what the recruiter promised me. The third period is military service. And this can be for varying length. For many soldiers, this doesn't entail war. This entails garrison duty or reserve duty. But in today's world, it basically means you're going overseas. Virtually all reservists will end up serving overseas at some point in their life, in Iraq or Afghanistan. For me, this was 1 year in Iraq. Right now, this is just a ballpark estimate. I'm sure it's not on, but it's in the neighborhood. We have about 250,000 soldiers deployed overseas. About 150,000 in Iraq, probably 50,000 in Korea, maybe another 50,000 in Japan and some more in Germany. So this is probably a low estimate. But we have approximately a quarter of our forces deployed. after military service, either when your enlistment expires, you're honorably discharged, or you return for some other reason, there's this period of homecoming. In my case, homecoming from war, but from a lot of soldiers that may be returning from basic training. It may be the termination of their reserve duty. But there's a period when, I would say, soldiers' enthusiasm or morale for the military is at a nadir. They finished whatever it was they were doing, and there's kind of a void in their life, especially for people who are returning from war, when nobody cares about your war stories, nobody wants to listen to you anymore, they're tired of you, you feel disconnected, you feel like you'd only talk to other veterans, and there's this huge gap in your life, and there's something wrong. And this is where, kind of in this period, where things like suicides or withdrawal from yourself or psychiatric problems develop. And you notice I've kind of scribbled this line here. This is kind of a barrier. It's a permeable barrier. But most soldiers never move from this point to political activation, to becoming activists. Most don't. Some do, on either the left or the right. But this is kind of the thing that we have to cross in order to get veterans to become activated. The final stage in my arc of the activist is the political activation or veteran status, where you become one of those veterans that they trot out to, like, be a token and give talks. This is what we're trying to get to, political activation for veterans. Amy and I were just talking about this earlier, not counting Vietnam veterans and previous conflicts, of which there are many. There's probably less than 50 veterans in America today who are from the current conflict who are very active speaking. Probably a lot less than 50 who are active, going around, giving talks, talking about their experiences. And at the final level of people who are really active on the national scene, traveling here and there and giving talks, is probably only 10 to 20 veterans from the current war who are really serious about talking and serious about activation. And so kind of the arc I want you to think about is how we go from 1 million active and reserve forces, and they go through a funnel of experiences, deployment, then political activation, and we come down to 10 to 20 people who are seriously interested in talking about their war experiences. Because there's a lot of disaffection. I mean, probably 95% of soldiers go through serious disaffection. But because nobody is there to catch them at this point, the military is able to fold them back into its ranks. And so what I want to talk about is where the peace movement is today and where they're putting their energy. And I would say that most of the energy of the peace movement goes in these two endpoints. An enormous amount of energy, and this is not a criticism, this is a good thing, is going into counter-recruitment. I've done it myself. I've spoken to probably 6,000 high school students in several different venues about, I don't like to call it counter-recruitment, but I like to call it honest recruitment. Because I don't think we can really make a good case to say you shouldn't join the military at all. But I think when you give people the facts about the military and you show them the alternatives, no thinking person will make the choice to enter the military. So that's how I like to frame it. We're putting an enormous amount here to stop people from entering the military. And we've been relatively successful with that. We've made a lot of progress. I mean, I think it was San Francisco voted all the recruiters out of schools, and there's been several other victories. The recruitment stand down with the unethical recruitment in Colorado. I don't know if you heard about that. So this has been a strong point. This has been a real victory. The other area where we're putting a lot of effort is in this. For people who are already politically activated, sending invitations to Amy and I, sending invitations to the, you know, celebrity veterans out there who are doing 95% of the talks and 95% of the activism. So this part is well covered. I think the peace movement is pretty well connected to Bring Them Home Now, Iraq Veterans Against the War, people who have already made this transition. What I want to talk about is these three stages where I think we need to focus a lot more effort into catching people, because I think the real defining moment for getting veterans involved is here and this barrier. To get the enormous number of returning veterans who are not satisfied with their experience or are disillusioned to make the leap from just being sitting at home feeling disaffected about the war to coming here and becoming an active veteran. And this is a whole gradation of experience. So I want Amy to kind of jump in on the sections that she's really been active in, which is the initial disaffection training and some of the military service.
Um,
We thought that as a group, we could come up with some ideas about concrete actions that we can take. To tell you the truth, one of the things, other than just like Aiden, working with young people, giving them options for their future, is this initial disaffection. There's a website called peace-out.com, peaceout.com, and it gives some basic information about military conscientious objection. On that website, there are 20 veterans who have been conscientious objectors who volunteer themselves and have their contact information for people to get advice, specific advice. And on a weekly, sometimes daily basis, I get emails from all over the world from soldiers asking for support. And in that case, I email back. Sometimes I give them my cell number, and we start this relationship I give them. So that typically happens in here. So that's something that that as a veteran and as a conscientious objector that I can do. But there are some concrete ideas about peace movement in general, reaching out to soldiers. I just want to ask the group, do you know where to find soldiers?
UWI.
Yeah. Wait.
I mean, how do you get in touch with soldiers?
How do you get in touch? Any idea?
Walter Reed
Hospital. Okay,
Reed is an Army hospital where they treat returning casualties. Another idea, if you didn't know, churches get mailing lists of soldiers to send them care packages overseas. And overseas, like in Iraq, we had like a mound of care packages like this high that people would just like toss onto the mound, because there were all these churches, like every church in St. Petersburg, all the way down to Naples, Florida, had our unit's address and was sending us care packages. And they had not only the address of the company, but the name and rank of every soldier in the company, so they could send them things. And what I'm saying is, rather than, you know, I'm not saying to pretend to be a church, but I'm saying that the peace movement can have access to those very same resources, and which leads into my idea for military service, which is, during the Vietnam era, so they say, I wasn't there, there were GI newspapers and underground newspapers and such for soldiers who were deployed and on base. I don't think that's really a reality now, and I don't think it's really a possibility overseas. You're not going to be set at clandestine printing press. But I think the way we can affect people who are on duty, who are at the war, who are on active military service, is through email and care packages. And I mean political email and care packages. For example, if the Baptist Church of St. Petersburg can send candy and shoe polish to soldiers overseas in little boxes and have one package go to every member of my company, there's no reason that the peace movement can't access the same file, send a care package to every member of that unit with candy and whatever you want, and also a little thing that says, you know, disaffected with the military? Here are some options.
Rights.
Here's conscious objection. Here's a number to call.
That's right.
Here's CCCO. Here's 1-800-GI-RIGHTS.
Exactly.
And here's War Resisters League on a little sheet of paper.
Exactly. The thing to understand is that lots of soldiers, like Aiden and myself, most soldiers don't even know they have any legal right to even pursue conscientious objection. It's not something they share with us. And so we use the internet as the, you know, searching on the internet. That's how you found the sample CO packet. That's how, you know, actually in my day it was like even harder to find out information. But if the church can send a little Bible, we can send a card that says, here are your rights, and here are, there's a whole bunch of people, there's a million people in the United States that want to help you, soldier, because we love you and care about you, and you have rights. And just getting that information to people who are on, you know, who are activated, who are serving in Germany and in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, can start the cycle. Because I get emails. Everybody has email, right? All soldiers have email. And although it technically, just like any, you know, the government could, you know, screen it or whatever, it's too big. They can't control it. So a lot of the soldiers through email can get in touch with support people in the States. One of the things that was mentioned is the GI Rights Hotline. The GI Rights Hotline is that War Resisters League and a whole bunch of other organizations have an 800 number and a website that specifically focuses on military people and their rights, you know, for discharges. And everyone in this room could get training as a counselor on the hotline. And I recommend, if you're serious about stopping the war and you want to talk to soldiers directly. That is the most concrete way that you can do that. You get in touch with War Resisters League or CCCO, objector.org. There's or GIRights.org.
Is it 1-800-GI-RIGHTS? Is that the number?
It's 1-800-9-FY.
Yeah, we don't know. But it's GIRights. It's GIRights.org. And you can sign up for a training. Once you get a training, basically the training is, all right, here, you know, here's the primer on the basic rights. Then you sit on the phone and you get calls from soldiers or their families. And that is the most concrete way for you to feel like you're helping support our troops, which I'm so sick of that phrase. You're supporting the troops by helping them to resist the war. Because in, you know, our experience bears out that most soldiers have a lot of questions about what the role is that they're playing.
And for people who have a question about the dynamic of how that would work, let me tell you my experience, which I think is pretty typical. All the disaffected members of a unit will cluster together. They all know each other. Everybody knows the people within a unit who are not with the team or not down with the war. And if you send out care packages, you only have to get one message to one person who's disaffected. And that will spread to everybody else in the unit who's having any doubts. It'll be like, oh, hey, man, I heard about this. Let me show you this. You know, I heard this about this GI Rights hotline. You know, I'm going to look it up next time I'm on the web or next time I have phone time. So all you have to do is get to one person. It's not like you have to change the company's mind. You get to that one person within in the company, and that will spread, kind of like a mind virus, if you want to call it that. But also by email. Every soldier, I don't know if you know this, there's for the Army, it's AKO. I think it's different for everybody else. But you have an official military email, and you get all your mail through that so they can screen you and whatever. But every member of the armed forces has an AKO email address and account, and you can look it up and find their name, their rank, where they're deployed, what unit they're with, and what their address is. Like if you want to send General Karpinski an email right now, you could go to AKO, look up her name, and send her an email address wherever she is. So that's possible for every soldier, and all you have to do is get one email to one member who's having doubts, and it'll spread to every member of that unit. I want to move to this, the return home discharge, and this chasm between being a discharged soldier and being an activist. This is something that's just near and dear to my heart, and we were talking about it earlier. And I'm going to throw something out here that might be a little challenging for people. I'm a very liberal person. I'm probably on board with, you know, 95% of the things that people discuss here. I'm ultra-liberal, you know, freedom and liberty and truth and justice. But when I come to these to an event like this, I feel out of place. I feel somewhat uncomfortable. Just because the way, you know, people dress and the way they act and stuff, it's a little jarring for me. And I grew up in under Sharia, like under Muslim law in Egypt. So I'm not used to seeing that kind of thing, even though I'm a very liberal person. Most soldiers are far more conservative than I. And if I walk into this room and I feel uncomfortable and I feel kind of like, oh, maybe I don't fit in here, then what is a soldier from Texas, Kansas, or Iowa going to feel when they walk in here with no sideburns, you know, wearing a white shirt, wearing jeans, you know, wearing dress shoes? What are they going to feel like? And how are they going to feel connected to this community? And I'm not saying that everybody here should put on a white shirt and a tie, nor that they should become like more like us. I'm saying there's a huge chasm of subculture and identity between returning soldiers and the people in this room and the people upstairs. And we need to work on a bridge between people who are, you know, like Kevin Benderman, who recently went to prison, who's a Georgian, he never went to college. He spent 10 years in the Army. You know, very rural Southern.
I can't believe you said that.
And how is he ever going to come into this room and feel supported and feel connected? And there's got to be a bridge between that experience, which is the bulk of people in the military, and the people in this room. And I think one of the bridges to get from there, well, first of all, it has to be gradual. If you push people too hard and too fast, you'll lose them. For example, if we go up to soldiers who are just coming back from the Army and maybe they're curious, and they come to see what the anti-war movement is all about, and they hear down into capitalism, into hierarchy, you know, into whatever, that's maybe a little bit too much. That may be like way outside their horizon of possibility and experience. So we need to kind of be more gradual. And I think one of the stages of that is Iraq Veterans Against the War. Because Iraq Veterans Against the War is made up of all veterans. We're all, you know, liberals, we're progressives, we're on board. But it's people they can feel comfortable with. It's people who've had the same experience, who are not too far out there. And then once a disaffected soldier comes into Iraq Veterans Against the War and begins to get a little taste of that, the infamous Iraq veterans in the war, they can transition to coming to events like this. And Iraq Veterans Against the War sends people out as speakers or as representatives to events like this. So I'm interested in people's ideas about how to cross that gulf, and I'm suggesting that Iraq Veterans Against the War and other organizations like that are a good intermediary between
right.
pure activism,
yeah.
people who've never been in the military, and pure soldiers or pure veterans. They're kind of a halfway step.
Right. That's the so the two takeaways we hope kind of emerge from this conversation is, one, that the message, as we support soldier resistors, we have to be thoughtful about the way that we message things. If you send a box of candy and a, you know, we love you and you have rights, that's very different than saying, here's the ultimate political objective of me sending you candy and telling you this. We don't need to go that, you know. So let's be very thoughtful about the message when we reach out. And we need to make sure there are veterans within the groups and organizing, because people like Aiden, people like me, are the bridges to get people coming back to help them gradually become the political activists and outspoken people that we absolutely need in order to educate the general American public about what's happening in the war, and to also encourage other soldiers. Because my own case in courage applying for a CO discharge came from a speech I heard when I was on campus. I heard this guy, Eric Larson, who was in the Marines. He took his dog tag, threw it down. He said, I'm not going to, you know. And I said, if he can do it, I can do it. And we need that. A strong cadre of veterans speaking out. Let me just say just one thing, which is that most of the active veterans who are speaking out are men, and the military is a male-dominated institution, but 20% of the military is women now. And so it's absolutely essential that we find messages and ways to support women resistors just like men. So Iraq Veterans Against the War is a male-dominated organization. We have to figure out how to make a space for women. By the way, half of the enlisted women in the Army are black. So if you want to talk about truly doing work and connecting with the communities, the people who become soldiers, then you must look at the people who make up the military and figure out the issues that people care about. So as a black woman, I actually represent the majority, right, of people who are in, of women that are enlisted, right? So connection with issues that we care about is very important. Okay, so that's a whole other workshop.
The way Iraq Veterans Against the War, the way we roll is someone says like, oh, there's this soldier who does this. And we're like, okay, I'll drive. Camilo and I drove. Joshua, I think he drove also. And we all like descended there. And we were there, the three of us, who were all COs. And we did our thing there. And the other activists came out of the woodwork also. And if you go back to Camilo Mejia's trial, who went to prison for being a CO, what they did is the military packed the court. They like detailed all the people from his unit. They're like, your job for today is to go to the courtroom and sit in opposition to Camilo Mejia, to sit on and fill up this side of the courtroom. So none of Camilo's people could come in and show support. And at Kevin Benderman's trial, there were like five people in the stands, and three of us were Iraq veterans. So I think one thing we can do in the future is activists can just like show up. But if the courtroom is like full of activists and people like stop the war and Iraq veterans against the war, it makes a strong statement. It makes a statement when those people are surrounding her all the time. So they don't have to just float in isolation like Kevin Benderman.
Right.
So that's one thing I hope that we can do is turn people out.
Right.
Both IVAW people and activists.
So for either one of you, what are some strategies of resistance you've seen by people who haven't been discharged or who aren't looking right now to be discharged? So looking at a broader spectrum of resistance and maybe some ways.
Okay, some other brainstorming ideas of how people have resisted. Fleeing to Canada is one thing. They say there's, how many of them are there out there?
1,000 is what I've
heard. 1,000 in people in Canada? There's 5,000 people deserted the armed forces during the Iraq War. And there's been 200 CO applications and maybe 3 or 4 approved. So like the number of people who get discharged as a CO is infinitesimal. Like it's not really relevant to the grand scheme, but the number of applications is. So about 1,000 people fled to Canada. Refusing orders is another thing, like what Catherine's done. Not quite the same thing.
in terms of other forms of resistance?
The other thing is sometimes when I get folks who contact me and we talk about the CO process, they say, you know what, I don't want to be harassed and I don't think it's going to work anyway. So there's been other strategies. I worked with a young man at Fort Drum, which is upstate New York, who took drugs, right? And then the way the military handles it is they give drug tests where he came and talked to his commander and he says, I have a drug problem. And so he took a risk because the commander could just assign him to, they have a drug treatment thing. But in that case, he got discharged. Now, the thing to understand about military discharges is there are many types of discharges in five broad categories. If a person is court-martialed, they most likely will get a dishonorable discharge. And friends of mine from the Persian Gulf War, you know, 15 years ago, who ended up getting court-martialed and got a dishonorable discharge, you know, one of them works for the city of San Jose and now is head of his union. One of them has a very successful, like, software company job. People will the thought that a bad discharge will destroy someone's life, unless they want to be a cop or an FBI agent, right, those kind of jobs, typically discharges like that don't impede a person's ability to make a
and
living
after
future.
After you get the discharge, you can apply to have the discharge upgraded after 6 months.
Right.
And you can apply again to have it upgraded again. That's what Camila Mejia
right.
is doing.
So if you're discharged for having a drug problem in the military, you get a general discharge, right? Or a health problem, you get a general discharge.
In the whole field of alternate discharges, some ways that people don't know about, you know, obviously there's the drug discharge, there's a homosexual conduct, and then there's a hardship discharge, which is economic hardship, basically, meaning like if you're deployed, your family can't survive without you. Or people have kids and don't have another caretaker. Two people in my unit, or actually four people in my unit, got out that way. Two sets of parents were released from my unit for a hardship discharge.
And it's harder to get hardship discharge.
You have to prove it.
I have to say I worked with a woman who'd been out, who was an officer. She lived in Virginia. She was an officer, served 4 years after ROTC, right, after she graduated from college. She served her time and she was discharged. But the military is starting, because they've extended the deployments of 50,000 soldiers, it was reported in the news last week. They're also going back and going to something called, IR, thank you. And this woman, even though she was honorably discharged as a second lieutenant, she was still in the IRR, and the military requires soldiers to actually separately just get discharged from the IRR, and she didn't know. They don't tell you. So they asked, after 10 years, are calling her back. Her husband's completely disabled. She has two children under eight. And so even though she'd been applying for a hardship exemption, they actually were not respecting that, and we were going to the Congress.
On the Constellation, but like, in my unit, we had two sets of parents, and they were the only caretakers for their children, and they were both deployed together. So, like, their kids were like, oh, you have no parents anymore. Both your parents are deployed together. So, like, the military has no regard for people's family. But it is on the Constellation, right. But it's difficult to prove.
So,
the other thing is, like, injuries, physical injuries, inflicted or not. So another way.
Okay, so there's another a question. I'm a mental health professional who has worked with combat vets in a VA hospital in the past. How can the mental emotional health needs of vets, especially resistors, be better met in the community context? Okay, so this is interesting, and I'm wanting to hear what Aiden says. I'll give my perspective. When we were talking about building community, thinking about the anti-war movement, in order to sustain it, so it doesn't go from war to war and from march to march, which I personally think is not very effective anymore. Maybe you guys disagree, but in order for us to have a sustained movement, we have to build a community that takes into account like the connections and at the personal level. That's it. That for me, I was very lucky. My as a public resistor, my military counselor was a conscientious objector named Leonard McNeil from the Vietnam era. And he would do things like send me send me notes and pictures and sometimes articles. He would ask me to lunch. We would, you know, go to stuff to get, just building a relationship on a very personal level. It helped me over years to heal, to be able to come out and to do what I'm doing now during the Iraq War, the stuff that I felt like I couldn't do, 10 years ago. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was just thinking about it in terms of what people can do in the community. I think what I want to put out there is maybe not what people want to hear. It's during this phase, I mean, I'm talking about people who come back from war. I don't know about people who return from just normal duty. You come back from war for a couple months, no community stuff is really going to be welcomed, I don't think. People are not willing to talk about it for a long time. It takes a while to kind of process it. But then there's this period, like there's this lull period, where after like the initial shock is worn off, where people are interested in telling their story. And usually all your immediate friends are sick of it. And I think what you can do there is just, as she was saying, like form friendships, because the military psychiatric system is nonsense. Like nobody accepts it. The last thing you want to do is go and talk to a captain about, oh, captain, you know, I feel sad about the military. He's gonna be like, oh, toughen up. That's, I mean, nobody wants to go and talk to a military officer who's a psychiatrist. So maybe they'll want to talk to like a counselor, you know, someone who's not involved with the military at all. That would be more welcome. But I guess what I would say is hit people towards the end, like in this area, and not immediately when they come back. Because the experience of all the guys in my unit was like, I can't talk to anybody outside the unit about what happened. I can't talk to anybody who wasn't there. There's like this total tunnel vision. Then later, 6 months later, a year later, people were like, you know, I'd like to tell my story of what happened to me. And that's like the best catharsis.
For the therapists in the room, there's an organization called Therapists for Peace. And what this group of trained therapists does is they're advocates for veterans. And a lot of veterans who come back in that period, after they return, start having symptoms of PTSD and other kinds of emotional, psychological problems. And they go to the VA and they ask for help. And many of these requests are denied. And so what Therapists for Peace are doing is they are doing an independent assessment using VA forms and then being an advocate for individual soldiers so that they can get the treatment that they so deserve. Part of the way that the irony of the war is the way that veterans, these 20-year-olds, 22-year-olds are coming back from war devastated, not only physically but emotionally, aren't getting the support that they deserve. Yeah. So that's a concrete thing that you can do as a therapist, and I encourage you to go on their website.
If it fires you up to do that or volunteer for GI Rights, let me tell you what it's like to be offered psychological service in the Army. You come back from Abu Ghraib, right? You've just spent 6 months inside Abu Ghraib. When all the torture's going on, there are all these killings of prisoners and other nasty goings on. They get us into a big tent in Kuwait City, and they said, they get a psychological assistant, a specialist, comes up here and he says, okay, anybody who's feeling suicidal, move over to the side. Anybody who's feeling homicidal, move over to the side. If you're going to beat your wife, mark it on the little data pad. And he hands you a little data pad and you check off. Did you ever encounter dead people in Iraq? Are you feeling like you're going to beat your children when you go home? If so, just check this box, and then we'll keep you here in Kuwait to receive treatment. So you can imagine how many people after 1 year in Iraq are like, oh, yeah, I'll stay for another 2 months in Kuwait.
Yeah.
Then when we come home to Fort Stewart, once again, they're like, oh, soldiers, you know, we care about you. If you want treatment, you can get free treatment as long as you want. Just stay at Fort Stewart and stay on active duty for another 6 weeks to however long and get treatment. And after 1 year overseas, guess how many soldiers decided to stay on active duty for another however many months to get treatment?
Great.
So, three of them ended up later, you know, in psychological treatment, so it wasn't that they didn't need it.
So I'm going to ask folks just, Amy and Aiden, as a closing question, looking at the war mattress analogy that you talked about, Amy, and the ways in which the soldiers are the pillar that hold up the process of war and the structures of war, and trying to connect that to Aiden's realization when he was overseas about the shared experience he had with the people he was guarding. So sort of like trying to put those two things together, and how do you go about building more of a global movement of resistance, right? And understanding, looking at soldiers who are on opposite sides of a conflict, but building some kind of solidarity there, understanding there. Is there a way to connect those two metaphors and those two experiences as a sort of closing question?
Or wherever you want to go.
Or wherever you want to go. It's a big one.
Whoa. Let me just say that there's an attempt on War Resisters International and other groups to connect conscientious objectors all over the world. One of the most amazing experiences that I had when my CO, I was still in the military and my CO case was still pending, was still fighting to get out of the military, and was publicly speaking out against the war, was I was sponsored to go on a trip with some other students to Israel and Palestine, and I met Israeli conscientious objectors. And I had this moment, this realization that not only am I not alone, or, you know, and I'm not just this freaky person that came to this, you know, but that there's a connection in my own mind. It's the human species trying to evolve